Good evening, everybody, and welcome back to Foundations. You come on in and grab a seat. Glad to have you back for our sixth and final session in church history, in particular, early church history. Now, guys, don't you just love church history? I mean, this is something that most of you, I trust, have probably never studied before. There's got to be something just somewhat refreshing on coming on a Wednesday night and hearing something you literally have never learned before. I remember when I first studied church history, I had a first go around in my undergraduate years because I did my first degree, my undergraduate degree in Bible, and I had to learn church history, and I felt probably like what you all are feeling, except I got graded on it. I had to take a test afterwards, and I just remember I didn't know the difference between Athanasius and you know what. It was just crazy to take it all in. And then when I did my master's degree, I had to take church history all over again because they don't assume when you're in seminary that you did a bachelor's degree in Bible. So they teach it all over again. It was helpful to me because I had to relearn it all yet again. I have written several articles over the years on church history, mainly because it's of interest to me. In fact, my dissertation that I just completed for my PhD about a year ago or so, a whole chapter is basically dedicated to church history and the history of how the Bible was interpreted literally. I love it. And tonight, what we're going to do is we're going to try to put a bow on it. We're going to finish. This will be the last session in our early church history. Now, the history of the Christian church from the time of Christ to this point can probably be best divided into three even parts. That's how we're going to divide it up for the purposes of foundations. The first third is what we are finishing tonight, what we call early church history, the first six centuries, roughly, of the Christian church. The second third of church history is what is known not as the early church. It's often described as the Middle Ages. Y'all are probably familiar with medieval times or the Middle Ages. That is the next several centuries. This is kind of arbitrary, but basically from the 7th century all the way to the 14th century. And then the third slice of the pie in church history is the Reformation era, which I would consider us still in. We are the outflow of the Reformation, which happened in the 1500s, the 16th century, all the way to the present. As I described, well, actually for you guys, it was Rick Blasey. I did this at Harris. In our first session for Foundations, we made it clear that how we're going to go about this class is we're going to provide all of the material in short six-week seminars. And we're going to rotate big topic to big topic to big topic to keep you interested. Now, for those of you that have been loving church history and really want to go to the 7th and 8th centuries, you're just going to have to be patient. We won't get there till the spring because next Wednesday night, Clint Presley will be here, and he is going to teach for the next six Wednesday nights here at this campus the Pentateuch. He's going to switch from history, which I've been teaching, to the Bible. He's going to start going through an overview of the first five books of the Old Testament known as the Pentateuch. So you be here next Wednesday night and have a frame of mind that we're changing topics. I am going to spend the next 6 weeks at our Harris campus, and I'm going to teach them for 6 weeks what I have spent the last 6 weeks teaching you. So if you have forgotten things I've said over the last 6 weeks, or you want to hear a new and improved version of what I've taught these last 6 weeks, here's a little spoiler. I'm going to clean up what I've been teaching you all over the last 6 weeks, and I'm going to try to make it a little better for my next go-around, you know, second time's a charm. So I'm going to try to do that for this next go-around. So it may be of interest to you to go watch those recordings, which we'll publish online as well, and maybe that'll help fill in some of the blanks, so to speak, for you. You guys know, you've been around me long enough to know my teaching style is I have notes and I don't look at them. I'm fairly extemporaneous. It's just how my mind works. So I watch you, and I can see the blank stares at times, and I can see the great interest at times. And so I'm constantly making mental notes based off what's landing and what's not landing, what's clear and not. So you guys have been very helpful. Lord willing, you are going to make a better church history presentation the next 6 weeks. But tonight, we're going to end it, and we're going to do so by combining two centuries into one session. I've spent one Wednesday for the last 5 weeks going through 1st century, 2nd century, 3rd, 4th century. Tonight, we are going to combine the 5th and the 6th century just because it will make sense. There's so much bleed over between the two. We'll combine it together, and I think it will prove fruitful for us and our purposes tonight. Be sure you're taking notes. If you didn't grab some, at that desk where Wendy is seated at the entry, we have note sheets that we publish every Wednesday night. By way of reminder, if you'd like, we sell these little notebooks that are designed to kind of fit these notes, or if you just want to put them in anything you want. I strongly recommend you take notes, you keep them. If you forgot notes, you lost your sheets, or you didn't grab them, or you missed a Wednesday, we archive them so you can pick up previous week's notes. We also publish them all online as PDFs if you'd like to just go print it off at home. Keep those notes. I work hard on these outlines. Not so that they're exhaustive, they can't be exhaustive. I do them so that you can have a launching pad, a point to jump off. And I kind of joked with you guys, but I'm serious about this. If anything, my goal is to get you guys to go Google stuff. I want you to go look up. I just had a brother tell me tonight that he was doing a little deep dive in Constantine, because I talked about him a couple weeks ago. I want you guys to be thinking about, okay, I want to know more about penance. Or Athanasius. I want to know what on earth is going on with the Council of Chalcedon. So I want to learn. I hope this class will help you do just that. Why don't you join me as we pray, and then we're going to dive in one last time to early church history. Let's pray. Father in heaven, as I've prayed these last several weeks, I'll pray yet again that this would not be a mere intellectual exercise. This would not be just something that stokes curiosity, but that this would be faith-building, soul-stirring, strengthening, I pray. Lord, I'm asking that you would use me in spite of me to edify these dear brothers and sisters as we trace your footprints over the last 2,000 years, as we examine your fingerprints over the last 20 centuries. Lord, I pray that this would strengthen the faith of my friends. And I ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. 5th and 6th centuries. As a reminder, the 5th century begins in 400, and the 6th century ends in 599. So we are going to cover the years 400 to 599 tonight. These years mark the formal end of antiquity. Antiquity is what most Western civilization folks would describe as the Roman Empire and its end. And after the Roman Empire falls apart and everything starts to finally settle down, we enter what's called the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages, the medieval era. Partly that's because so much culture began to happen in all these tribal lands all over the place. There wasn't a centralized organization that the Roman Empire afforded. So as you might expect, what would be the first highlight of the 5th and 6th century I want to draw your attention to this evening? As you might expect, the first thing we really need to take note of is, if you'll notice with me on your notes, first off, I want you to see, you're going to see the rise of barbarian invasions, and in particular, this causes the fall of Rome. Now, let's talk about that for a moment. Rome, the great Roman Empire. You've noticed its fingerprints over the last several centuries of church history. Rome controlled it all. But if you were to look at a map, in fact, I think I have a map on the screen that you could take a look at. If you'll notice on the map, there you go, that the Roman Empire, which kind of surrounded the Mediterranean Sea as we know it today, there was a lot of land north of the Roman Empire. It's the yellow on the screen. It was what we would call today Central or Northern Europe. Did you realize that that portion of Europe was not controlled by the Roman Empire? It was filled with tribal Germanic peoples. All these Germanic tribes that were individualized spread out throughout central northern Europe. Well, these tribes were all living happily at peace, and they were north of Rome, of the Roman Empire. The Romans called all these tribes up in the north barbarians. Now, why do they call them barbarians? It's not because they were barbaric. These people were called barbarians because they did not speak Greek or Latin. They just were barbarian. They didn't communicate the way we civilized Roman citizens do. They were other. They were the barbarians. But then things got a little crowded, and the barbarians started to be pushed down into the empire. And do you want to know what caused it? What was the force that pushed the barbarians from their lands all over northern Europe into the Roman Empire? There was this insurgent force that had come from the east, from the area of Mongolia, from Central Asia. This famed, infamous character in history you've probably heard of, named Attila the Hun. Y'all ever heard of Attila the Hun? He's often joked he and Genghis Khan are kind of the two Asian infamous people of history who caused great havoc in Western civilization. Attila the Hun led the Hunnic Empire out of Asia and started coming into Europe. And as they came into Europe, those Huns were barbaric. They were killers. And as they were coming into Europe, they started to push some of the tribes out. There was a general word used to describe all these Germanic tribes, all these barbarians. Generally speaking, they were called the Gothic people. Now, don't think Gothic like it's been used today. The Goths, they were a name used to describe all these tribes. Now, you could slice these tribes into two general segments, the Eastern Goths and the Western Goths. They had names. The Eastern Goths were called Ostrogoths, and the Western Goths were called Visigoths, the two different groups. Well, here's why we call one half of them Eastern Goths and why we call one of them Western Goths. The Eastern Goths, the Ostrogoths, when the Huns started to come from the east, they didn't really go anywhere. They basically got conquered, absorbed into the Hunnic Empire. But there were some of their Gothic neighbors on the west who smartly ran away. The Visigoths, the Western Goths, they kept moving west. They wanted to get away from these Huns. And so where can you go? If the Huns are coming, you got to go into the Roman Empire. So they come down south. And the Visigoths start heading south, escaping Attila the Hun, and they land in the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire actually received them. They brought them in, but they did, as so many nations have, they started to treat them racially, intolerantly, and they started to abuse the Visigoths in the Roman Empire. And here's what happened. The Visigoths, as you might expect, didn't take too kindly to this, and they caused an uprising. They started to fight the Roman Empire, and something happened in the year 378 AD that had never happened in Roman Empire history. The Visigoths shockingly won. They fought, and they actually conquered the inconquerable. The Visigoths, at the famed Battle of Adrianople, in 378 AD, they actually rebelled against Rome, won, killed the emperor, and the Visigoths, a couple things happened as a consequence. One, the Visigoths started to spread out all through the land, and secondly, word spread really quickly. Rome started to recall its soldiers from all over Europe to come and protect the mother city, Rome. We don't want these Visigoths to sack us. So they called in all the soldiers, and guess what happened? The minute you pull soldiers out from all of their outposts, well, now all the other tribes start to realize, oh, this land's up for grab now. They're out of town. I hate to make light of this, but we are experiencing this uniquely as American citizens watching what took place in Afghanistan. When you have soldiers withdrawn, there's a vacuum, and people came into that vacuum. This is what happened in the Roman Empire. As the soldiers were withdrawn to come protect Mother Rome, all the other tribes, these Germanic tribes, like, hey, there's more land to grab. Let's start going. So the Visigoths have now now come into Italy, modern Italy. They are coming closer and closer to Rome until at last one of the leaders of the Visigoths, a man named Alaric, he sacked Rome in 410. Mark that year down, 410. It's the first time the great city of Rome was sacked. This would be akin to Washington, D.C. being conquered by the Soviet Union 30 years ago. A really big deal. Alaric comes and defeats the mother city of Rome, sacks it. And there was a famous man who we talked about last week, a famous Christian, Augustine. Y'all remember me talking about Augustine of Hippo? Augustine was alive when this happened. He was in Hippo, which is in North Africa, just across the water from Rome. And he was pastoring his people who were freaking out. They could not believe that Rome had been defeated. And they started to think, is God real? Can he be trusted? How could this great city of God, Rome, be defeated? And he wrote one of the most famous books in ancient church history. It's a book you ought to have, although I admit it's huge. It's a book entitled The City of God. Y'all ever heard of it before? The City of God? Augustine wrote this book called The City of God, and it is Augustine writing as a pastor to Christians, helping them understand that kingdoms rise and kingdoms fall, but there is one city that will remain. Rome was never promised to be an ancient city. The United States is not promised to last forever. There is one kingdom that's unshakable. There is one city that will abide. All of these cities, Rome, D.C., Charlotte, you name it, London, Paris, they are but cities of man. There is one city that will abide, the city of God. In other words, Augustine was trying to help people understand that God is sovereign and Alaric of the Visigoths has nothing on God. Augustine wanted you to see that you are sojourners. We are but exiles. That doesn't mean we put our heads in the sand and pretend politics aren't real. It means you don't make politics your God. You recognize that there is no political person who can save you. There is a sovereign God whose heart, who the heart of the king is in his hands. He'll turn it as he will. There is a God who is ruling. Augustine famously counseled God's people while Rome was collapsing. Trust God. We don't need Rome for the kingdom of God to advance. So you see the Visigoths, this Germanic tribe that comes in, invades the Roman Empire. They take over modern Italy. Now I want you to notice another group that comes into play. Another group was called the Vandals. Y'all ever heard of the Vandals before? The Vandals were another Germanic tribe way up in North Central Europe. And once they learned that the Visigoths were successful, and once they saw that all the Roman soldiers were escaping the outskirts of the empire to come protect Rome, they started to advance. They were driven by the Huns as well. They were trying to get away from these Huns, but they started to move, and they went all the way around to modern-day France and Spain, which is called the Iberian Peninsula. And if you go to the bottom of Spain, there's a little tiny jut of land that goes to this little body of water called the Strait of Gibraltar. They crossed that strait and they were now in what we would call modern day Morocco, and they started to make their way over the North African coast where they conquered all those lands. They basically took over the Roman Empire, which was south of the Mediterranean Sea. Now the Vandals, they defeated Carthage, they defeated Hippo where Augustine was. In fact, believe it or not, the Vandals sacked Hippo like a month before Augustine died. You can see in his writings him talking about the Vandals approaching the city, laying siege on the city, and he died before they took over it all. He was an eyewitness to this. Now, the Vandals, they got tired of their victory and they wanted a little bit more. So they got on the boats and they went across the water to the north, and they decided if the Visigoths could sack Rome, how about we try? And so they make it over, and guess what they did? They went and they too sacked Rome, but they did some horrible stuff. When they went to Rome, they vandalized Rome. That's where we get the word vandalize. It comes from the Vandals who came and defaced the Roman city of Rome, the great imperial city. They came and vandalized that great city, the Vandals who took over Northwest Africa. Now, remember me telling you about those Eastern Goths, those Ostrogoths who got absorbed into the Hunnic Empire? Well, they finally got freed from the Huns. Attila died. They finally got freed up and they started to come into the land. And this was a few years later after the visit crazy Goths had kind of taken over everything. There was a man named Odoacer. He was the man who killed the final Roman emperor in the year 476. And the year 476 is a big year. Write that down. It's the year the Roman Empire collapsed officially. There was no longer a Roman emperor after the year 476, and the Ostrogoths took over the land. They became the rulers of Italy. Then lastly, I want you to see that there were some folks that took over the region we now know as France. In fact, we call France, France, because the tribe that conquered that land were called the Franks. We get France from the tribal name the Franks. These were a Germanic people that came and took over that land. The Franks, they were pagan atheists. These people did not believe in God. They worshiped trees and whatnot. But there was another tribe that was Christian, although they were what you might call Arian Christians. Do you guys remember me talking about the Arian controversy last week? Heresy? Arius? That was the belief that Jesus did not exist eternally. He came into being at Christmas, at the incarnation. These people, the Burgundians, they were Arian Christians, and they conquered the lands called Burgundy to this day. It's basically eastern France. It's kind of the border of France. The Burgundians. Scratch out Lombards. I did not mean to write that in there. It was published before I could edit it out. And then lastly, I want you to see what happened to the land that so many of us came from. I recognize not all, but our country is inextricably tied to that Isle of Great Britain. How did the gospel, or how did people get there? How did we become people from Great Britain? Well, these Germanic tribes ended up spreading out to that isle. There were a tribe called the Angles. There was a tribe called the Saxons. They were both in northern modern Germany. And then there was a tribe called the Jutes. And they were in what's called modern-day Denmark. If you go look at a map, Denmark is like this little tiny peninsula that juts out. In fact, it's called Jutland. It's this land that juts out from Germany. These tribes made it over the water, and they took over Great Britain. They coalesced and became eventually known as Anglo-Saxons. And these were the Angles and the Saxon tribes, and Jutes for that matter, that had come together, and they spread out and conquered those lands. So I want you to see, firstly, no longer was Rome king. Rome fell, barbarians were over all the lands, and now we have a problem. Previously, when Constantine became emperor, and he made Christianity the official religion, everybody was a Christian. Everybody knew about Jesus. There wasn't this big compulsion to evangelize because the presumption was, of course you're a Christian. You might get killed if you're not. Everybody is one. But when the barbarians came and destroyed the Roman Empire, and now these barbarian tribes were over all of Europe, guess what Christians now had to do? They now had the opportunity to do mission work. Not to suggest that it wasn't possible before. We, of course, recognize cultural Christianity was rampant. But they literally now knew there were barbarian people who did not follow Jesus, who worshiped trees. So secondly, the second highlight of the 5th and 6th century I want you to see is in the wake of the fall of Rome, in the wake of the barbarian invasions, was number two, the rise of missions. Now, I cannot, for the sake of time, be exhaustive, but I want to give you a brief overview of how the gospel got from Rome and started to spread into Germany, how it spread into France, how the gospel spread up into Great Britain, for example. These are just it's just a little appetizer. I just want to walk you through just a couple names that you might know. I bet you all know the first name. How many of you in this room have heard of a little guy named St. Patrick? Did you ever think he was just kind of fake, make-believe? He was actually a real individual. St. Patrick, Patrick is how we would describe him. No, we're only saints because of the blood of Jesus. There is not, I wouldn't canonize him, in other words. Patrick. Let me tell you a little bit about Patrick. Patrick grew up in Great Britain, modern-day England. Patrick was the son of a Roman Catholic deacon. a man who helped serve the church. And that deacon at those days were a little bit more involved even with what you might conceive of a deacon today. It was you did a whole lot in that day and time. This deacon, he was from a churched family. But then when he was a teenager, he got captured, kidnapped by Irish pirates, raiders. They captured this little boy and they took him to Ireland where he was enslaved with a shepherd. He basically became a shepherd in enslavement, and he just took care of this sheep and pastures for several years until he finally escaped. He finally got out of Ireland. He came back home to Great Britain, and while in Great Britain, after a few years, he started to have all of the... Oh, I got ahead of myself. You need to know this. While he was tending all those sheep, he had a lot of time on his hands. He was out there looking at God's creation, and over a period of years, he came to Christ. He knew a lot about Jesus from his dad, but he didn't know him. And you all know the difference, right? And while he was out there pasturing those sheep, he started to see the glory of God. He came to Christ, he escaped, came back to Great Britain, and while in Great Britain, a few years later, he started to have all these dreams, these visions. And in these dreams or visions, he kept seeing Irish people going to hell. He kept seeing all these people he knew in captivity being bound for hell, and he felt compelled to go and share Jesus with them. So off he went, and he went to Northern Ireland, where he evangelized that region, and he became known, famous, as the man who brought legitimate Christianity to the nation of Ireland. In fact, I don't know if this is true. A lot of sources debate it, but they'll say he took the shamrock, the three-leaf clover, which is kind of the symbol of good luck in Ireland, and used it as an illustration to describe the Trinity. He was trying to contextualize the gospel in that region. I don't know if that's true. Go look it up and you guys be your own judge. All that to say, Patrick was the instrument in the Redeemer's hands to bring the gospel to Ireland. Okay, now we've moved from Ireland. Let's talk now about Germany. How did the gospel get up to modern day Germany, that great Germanic region where all these barbarians had come from? I want to tell you about a little guy named Boniface. Boniface, he was bold. I might call him Boniface the Bold. Because one day it's reported that he came to a cultic pagan worship service. All these Germanic peoples were surrounding the great tree of Thor. They believed Thor was a god, which, by the way, we have Germanic influence to this day. Thor's Day is where we get Thursday, and Woden Day is where we get Wednesday. Two pagan Germanic gods. We have a little bit of holdover to this day. They were surrounding this tree of Thor. Now, if you were an evangelist and you saw all these pagans standing around a tree worshiping God, worshiping the tree, they probably all had axes. What would you do in that moment? You probably wouldn't do what Boniface did. He came and he chopped the tree down right in front of everybody. He took out an axe and cut the tree down. And when he did, all the Germanic people stood back aghast and thought, mercy, he's about to be killed. The lightning's going to fall. Our God is going to take him. Which, of course, didn't happen. And Boniface took the wood from that tree and he built a church. And that church was the beginning of the Christian movement throughout the Germanic peoples. Pretty wild story, isn't it? Boniface, used of God to bring the good news of Jesus into modern-day Germany. Let's move on to, how did the gospel get to England? How did it get up to that island? We know that Patrick took the gospel to Ireland, which is connected to the body, the island called England, right across the little water. But how did the gospel get to England? Well, let me tell you a story about this. It's reported that Gregory the Great, who was a pope that we're going to come to in a moment, he one time was in a slave market, and he saw these beautiful white little boys being sold into slavery. They just looked different from all the other people being sold into slavery. And he noticed them and said, whoa. When I say white, I don't mean just like as opposed to black. I mean like they were very white. These were very clearly Angles. Anglo-Saxons. They did not look Germanic. They did not look Italian. They did not look Middle Eastern. They looked very white. And he had not really seen too many of these. And he said, who are these people? And the person who was alongside Gregory said, they're Angles. And he said, these aren't Angles. These are angels. And he was so moved by seeing these little children that this Pope, Gregory the Great, the Bishop of Rome, he commissioned a group of missionaries to go from the Church of Rome and to go bring the gospel to the land of the Angles, the land of the Anglo-Saxons, Great Britain. And the man who led this charge was a man named Augustine of Canterbury. Don't confuse him with Augustine of Hippo. That was the one we've talked about last week. This guy is a whole lot less well known, but he's the guy who led the charge to bring the gospel into England. You may see his name sometimes called Augustine of Kent instead of Canterbury. Now let's quickly move on to one final region that you might want to hear about. This one is kind of interesting because it's hard for me to even describe this as an instrument of God. But there was a king in Gaul, which is what we call France, a king named Clovis. And Clovis got in a jam. He was in a battle, and he did what a lot of people have done over the years when they're desperate and they don't know the Lord. They cry out to him. We heard a story recently of an airplane that took off from Charlotte and its engine blew out right upon takeoff. It was when I preached in the summertime because I illustrated it in one of my sermons, so maybe June or July. And when the plane took off and they thought it was going to crash, all these people started yelling out for Jesus. It's a very common thing to have people that otherwise don't know him to start crying out to him. Well, this King Clovis, he starts to cry out, Jesus, help me, Jesus, help me, because he wanted to win the battle. And it appears Jesus helped him, for he won the battle. And upon winning the battle, Clovis said, if he's good enough for battle, he's good enough for life. And Clovis started to follow Jesus and made all of the Frank people, the French people, follow him. So there's a little cultural Christianity going on here too, I must admit. But he was the instrument that began a Christianity wave through modern day France. There's just a sampling. There's so many more names. I could spend the next 3 hours talking to you about instruments in the Redeemer's hands that brought the gospel from the Roman Empire into all these barbarian tribes. But let's just put a point on it and say, number two, these centuries show us not only the fall of Rome, but in its wake, the rise of global missions. Now, thirdly, you heard me talk about Pope Gregory the Great. I touched on the idea of a pope last week. Let's return to it tonight because this is where these centuries are where you actually see the pope come into play. Now, the pope. We're all familiar with the pope, are we not? I mean, it's crazy how our secular news media could care less about the Christian church until there's a new pope to be had. And then it becomes a round-the-clock news story. It's a testimony to the unusual influence that role has had throughout the last 2,000 years. Let's talk about the rise of the Pope. You may hear it described like this, the rise of the papacy. Papacy means the office of the Pope. Let's talk about where this came from. Well, first off, I want you to notice with me three different factors. There are political factors, theological factors, and what I call biographical factors that led to the rise of the Pope in Christianity. Let's talk firstly of some political factors. Now, if you recall, the Pope, which comes from the word papa, which means the father of the church, the Pope has always been the Bishop of Rome. Now, why the Bishop of Rome? Because there were some political factors at play. As you know, Rome was the leading capital of the Roman Empire. That's where you get the name Roman Empire. Rome was prominent. It was the original capital. Now, if you recall, when Constantine became emperor, do y'all remember what he did? He moved the capital from Rome elsewhere. He moved it to what we know today as modern-day Istanbul, but he named it then after himself, Constantinople. That was the original name. He moved the kingdom, the seat over there. Now, the clergy, the pastors, the bishops didn't like that. Because now you have the Bishop of Constantinople, and he's all of a sudden becoming a big deal because he's the bishop of the mother church, of the mother seat. But there's the Bishop of Rome that's like, hey, we were the original capital. We are where it's at. And they started to say, okay, there's more reasons why you should take me seriously. Not just because I was the pastor of the church at Rome. You should take me seriously because I'm the guy who sits in the seat that the great Peter sat in. So he started to say, listen, don't take me seriously because I'm just politically at advantage. You should take me seriously because of Peter. In fact, there was a man named Damasus. He was a pope, and he's the first guy in church history who declared, hey, I should be considered the leader of this church because Jesus said so. He cites Matthew 16 and verse 18. You are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. He thought that meant, you are Peter, and on Peter I will build this church, which Protestants believe Jesus is saying, you are Peter who had just confessed Christ, and on this confession, faith, I will build this church. In other words, we believe Jesus is the head of the church, but Roman Catholicism from that point forward started to see Peter as the guy who was given the keys to the kingdom. Peter was given primacy. Peter was the top dog. Peter was the first pastor at the church at Rome. Peter was the guy who started the bishopric of Rome. Any person who came from Rome, who came from Peter had the right, the apostolic succession, the right to become the guy who ran the church. The Pope began to be the person who followed after Peter. And the guys at Constantinople, as you might expect, they didn't like that at all. And you start to see, and I'm going to get to this at the end of our time tonight. Watch this. You're going to start seeing a slow separation. The West and the East are going to start splitting, slowly but surely. The West centers around the Pope at Rome. The East is going to start centering around the bishop at Constantinople. It's not happening in these centuries. It just starts. But let's just focus on the West for a second. Let's talk about the Pope, because I bet you everybody in this room knows the name of the Pope today, and I bet you not a single person in this room knows the name of the bishop of Constantinople today, who, by the way, is still here, and I'll show you his picture at the end of the night. But we all know the Pope because of its cultural influence. The Pope, the bishop of the most important church in the most important city on earth, this church that had 30,000 Christians or more, this church, the city that had been the ruling, reigning of the Roman Empire, this great church at Rome, this church that had some significant influential people lead it. For example, let me give you two biographical factors that led to the rise of the papacy. One was by one of the popes named Leo the Great. Mark his name down. Leo the Great took what Damasus said, and he declared, I am preeminent because I follow in the footsteps of Peter. He had a bit of a Messiah complex, Leo the Great did. And let me tell you what Leo did. When Attila the Hun and Alaric the Visigoth came into the Roman Empire, Leo was alive. He was the bishop of Rome then. And guess what Leo the Great did? As Attila came, history tells us that Leo, as the Pope, went by himself out and met Attila the Hun, the famed, infamous Attila the Hun, that murderous man. And he said, you shall go no farther. You shall not attack this city, for this city, Rome, is the city of God. And when Leo declared that to Attila, guess what Attila did? You'd expect him to just cut his head off. Attila was so impressed, he stopped. And he said, okay, we won't destroy the city. We're just going to loot you a little and leave. And that's all he did. He took some loot to pay for his way back home, and he turned around. The rest of the Christians are like, okay, that guy's got some stuff. That's what made the Bishop of Rome start to be seen not just as a politically hungry guy. They started to see him as, oh, this guy has legitimacy to lead. I mean, who would do that? They started to see him truly as a father of the church, as a papa of the church, as a pope of the church, Leo the Great. But there was one other guy who gave even more legitimacy to the office of the pope. And by the way, I'm going to change tune in a moment, lest you think I'm a papal guy myself. There was one other guy who made the Pope's office look pretty good, and that was a guy named Gregory the Great. Gregory the Great was the first pope to formerly be a monk. He lived a simple life. He was beloved in Italy. He was known as a servant of servants. He was kind of like the archetype of the current pope. If you guys know, our current pope today, Francis, has kind of fancied himself as a servant of servants. He's kind of tried to show a lot less taste for luxury than his predecessor. Francis is a little bit of a mirror image of this Gregory the Great. He lived a very simple life. Gregory, perhaps, is best known as the guy where we get some of the earliest Christian music. In fact, I have a short 40-second YouTube video I want to play for you tonight of some of the earliest Christian music. Do y'all realize that we haven't been singing the Gaithers for the last 2,000 years? Chris Tomlin is just a recent phenomenon. Prior to this, these days of Christian contemporary music, some of the earliest Christian music was called Gregorian chant. Now, I was joking. We have one of our Sunday school teachers, community group leaders in our church, Max Miller. If y'all ever talked to Max before, he's sitting on the back row. He has a voice like the voice of God. I'm not kidding you. His voice is so deep and resonant. I imagine that's what God will sound like one day. And I wanted to bring Max up here and just sing the Gregorian chant for you because his voice is perfect for it. I wanted to spare you my voice, but alas, hear just for a second, a 40-second clip of what music sounded like, this music that originated with Gregory the Great, Gregorian chant. Now, you didn't understand it because it was written in Latin, the tongue of the day, but this Gregorian chant was basically straight Bible. It's pretty rich music. Go Google it. You can listen to hours and hours of Gregorian chant. It is still sung in many churches around the world. That's probably one of the great legacies we have from Gregory the Great. Now, let's talk very quickly about some contradicting factors, because some of you may be sitting there thinking, well, I didn't know Kyler was a papal guy. Sounds like he's awfully keen on the Pope. And I don't think that works for a Baptist preacher. I must confess I am not. I believe the papal office is a fraud. I believe that the office of the Pope is unbiblical. I just want to offer you very briefly some reasons why we should not view the papal office as biblical, why we don't follow a pope. These reasons are somewhat of a delineation. They're somewhat derived from a pastor that I've mentioned to you before, a guy named Tommy Nelson, who pastors a church in Dallas, Texas. Let me just briefly delineate a few of these reasons. First off, the office of the pope contradicts Jesus' teaching on leadership. Jesus is very clear that the greatest shall be the least. He never exalted any one individual. He barely exalted himself for that matter. So it just contradicts his whole theory of leadership. It contradicts the whole Bible's theory of leadership. The whole biblical wisdom on leadership is one of plurality. Never does the Bible say one man should make all the decisions among men. The Bible is very clear that there should be a plurality of decision makers to hold one another accountable. I want you to see also it contradicts the biblical picture of church government. The Bible never describes a hierarchy. Once again, it describes local church elders, nothing ever above it. You realize the Bible never describes any office above the local church. That's why Hickory Grove is autonomous. The Southern Baptist Convention has zero power over us. There is no authority over the church. The leaders of the church are the leaders of the church. Full stop. That's the portrait the Bible paints. I want you to see, let's talk about Peter in particular. Should Peter be considered better than others? Well, first off, the New Testament's portrait of Peter is not a good one. If y'all read about Peter, I mean, Jesus literally says, "Get behind me, Satan," to Peter. Peter is not exactly what you'd call exemplary. Peter, after promising Jesus he'd do all these things for him, denies Jesus three times right after he's arrested. The rooster crows. Peter is portrayed as a deeply broken individual. He's not presented as some sort of exemplary, perfect individual. Peter himself describes himself as a fellow elder in 1 Peter 5:1. He describes himself as one of many, not as one above. I want you to see that the city of Rome, you might think, okay, well, maybe not Peter, but the church at Rome should be taken more seriously. The Bible nowhere describes the city of Rome as anything but just a geographical entity. It does not describe it as some sort of pinnacle. The Bible talks a heck of a lot more about Jerusalem than it does about Rome. Rome does not have some unique spiritual implication. I want you to see that the New Testament always describes the apostles in the plural form. It's always talking about men, not a man. Jesus is the cornerstone of the church, and on that cornerstone is built the witness of the apostles, plural. There's a reason there's a whole lot more letters by Paul than Peter, and why most of you probably know more about Paul than you know about Peter. Peter did not have some sort of unique role, plural apostles. And then lastly, just to reiterate this, Christ is the foundation of the church. Matthew 16 and verse 18 make clear, Peter, you are Peter, and on this confession, this rock, I will build my church. Jesus is the rock. The rock is always described as Jesus throughout the, as the Lord throughout the Bible, and it is on this confession that the church is built. So that's just a really quick way for me to say, I want you to hear that there is a deep-seated conviction that the authority of the local church is not subservient to some bishop in a city called Rome. The papal office ought not biblically have any authority over the local church. Okay, off my soapbox, let's move on to the fourth point. Number four, I want you to see, we got some more heresies to talk about. Y'all excited about some more heresies? I'm going to give you guys like a little list so you can have them all lined up because I recognize there's a whole lot of names to think through. I want to briefly address three tonight. The first is a heresy called Pelagianism. You may have heard of Pelagianism. Pelagianism originated with a British monk named Pelagius. Now, this British monk, which is interesting, as early as these centuries, you already see a monk over in Great Britain having a lot of authority. This monk took issue with Augustine, Augustine of Hippo. He took issue with Augustine's high view of the sovereignty of God. He thought, and maybe rightly so, in other words, it's understandable why you would have this debate. He thought that Augustine's high view of God's sovereignty basically made man have no responsibility. Which is, by the way, if you believe man has no responsibility, that's a huge problem. That's fatalism. That's determinism. That's just controlling. That's robotic. Well, he overcorrected, as so many do. And because he saw Augustine's view as problematic, he swung too far the other way, and he rejected original sin. He rejected the idea that we are born sinners, and he thought it was actually possible not to sin. He rejected total depravity, and he said, well, you cannot, theoretically, you don't have to sin. You could potentially live perfectly. It's highly unlikely, nobody ever does, but you could. And he rejected God's sustaining grace. He rejected the idea that you need the Spirit of God to fight sin. He thought it was fully capable for man in and of himself to live a holy life, to fight the fight of faith, to do what he needs to do. You don't need God's help. You can just do it on your own. Well, Augustine took great issue with Pelagius's view, and he refuted Pelagius. And he countered, no, we are born in original sin. We are the children of Adam and Eve. When you are born with a natural inclination to sin. You don't have to be taught it. You naturally know how. Which, by the way, if you don't believe me, I'll take you down to the preschool floor Sunday morning. We'll open the one-year-old's room, and they're biting each other. I hope mom and dad didn't teach them. I'll close that door, walk with you into the two-year-old's room where they're stealing from one another. In the three-year-old's room where they're throwing blocks at one another. This, my friends, is a funny but true illustration of original sin. In fact, Augustine, he famously said that man is so sinful that an infant child, if it had the strength, would strangle its mother to get milk. It's kind of a graphic way to say Children are screaming, not because they're just cute and innocent. They're screaming because they have a natural impulse to what they want, when they want, how they want it. We are all born this way. We just have more respectable versions of this sin when we walk into the foster class, for example. And maybe blocks aren't being thrown, but thoughts are being had in one another's heads because we are all sinners. My point is simply the man named Pelagius and his view that you don't need original sin, Pelagianism, it ended up being condemned at the Council of Ephesus. Write that down, Council of Ephesus in 431. That is a big church council. That's a big thing. Go Google the Council of Ephesus, 431. Pelagianism, is God actually sovereign? Now let's look at the second heresy. This is where it gets technical again. Have you all noticed so many of these heresies are feel like you're like how many angels can stand on the pinhead? This is one of those where it's like you're trying to figure out who Jesus is, and it's very confusing. There was a man named Nestorius. He was the bishop of Constantinople, and he asked this question. Can Jesus, who has two natures, he's God and man, can that really be one person? If Jesus is God and also man, how can those two things actually exist in one person? He didn't think that was possible. He rejected it, and he mainly rejected it because there was a common belief in that day that Mary, the mother of Jesus, she was referred to as the Theotokos, which is God-bearer. And he didn't like the idea that a mere woman could bear God. He thought that was inconceivable. And so he rejected the idea that somebody with two natures like Jesus could exist in one person. So he had this really weird view that honestly is hard to describe. So if you don't get it, you're in good company. He basically said Jesus existed not really with a union of two natures. He had two natures, but they kind of existed in two persons. But he doesn't really describe what that means. It's really hard to understand, truth be told. But it was condemned at the Council of Ephesus 2 in the year 431. Today, you can find Nestorians, people who believe this, in modern-day northern Iran, of all places. There's about 400,000 people that are Nestorians that believe this about Jesus living in modern-day Iran. Have you all ever heard of the Kurds, the Kurdish people? They tend to follow wherever the Kurdish people are. You'll see Nestorians to this day. Now, quickly and lastly, let me show you a third heresy. This is the opposite of Nestorianism. I want to talk to you about a guy named Eutyches, and he had the heresy of Eutychianism. Eutyches was a monk in a monastery in Constantinople, and he disagreed with Nestorius. He thought the opposite. He said, can Jesus, who is one person, really have two natures? He basically asked the same question, but looked at it from a different way. He's saying, okay, well, if Jesus is one person, can he really have two natures? And he concluded, no, that Jesus is really God, and his humanity kind of got absorbed into his godness. He used this illustration. Jesus' humanity is kind of like a drop of honey dripped into the sea. It gets dissolved and absorbed in the sea. It's there, but really all you see is sea. That's what he thought Jesus' natures, or Jesus was God with just a little drip of humanity that got absorbed in his divinity. It was them trying to wrestle with who is Jesus. And that view was condemned at the Council of Chalcedon in the year 451. Go Google that. It'll give you some interesting food for thought. Now, finally, with the few minutes we have remaining, I want to give you one fifth and final highlight of these two centuries. A highlight that I gave you a little bit of a taste, a little bit of a heads up on probably about 10 minutes ago. The final marker of the early church, which is something that's going to set us up for the Middle Ages, we're going to return to next year when we address the Middle Ages, is these centuries, this concluding era of the early church, marked a growing drift between the West and the East. I want to describe it like this. You'll start to see the rise of Eastern Christianity. Now, that may not mean much to you. You probably know Eastern Christianity today by the name Eastern Orthodoxy. Y'all ever heard of the Eastern Orthodox Church? What you probably hear more commonly are either the Russian Orthodox Church or the Greek Orthodox Church. Those are subsets. but in general, a counter movement. There was Roman Catholicism in the West, and there was Eastern Orthodoxy that began to develop in the East. Roman Catholicism, as you might imagine, centered in Rome with the Pope, the Bishop of Rome. Eastern Orthodoxy centered in the other capital, Constantinople. There were a few things that I want to draw your attention to. This doesn't formally happen, by the way, till around the year 1000. So we've got several centuries to go. But you're going to see the split begin to happen. Let me show you a few ways you see the East and the West begin to drift apart. And you're going to see these things spelled out in the centuries to come. First off, you're going to start seeing the West, Roman Catholicism, talk about salvation differently than the East. Here's how it happened. The West, which we are products of the West talked about salvation in legal or judicial terms. We do that. Y'all ever heard Clint or I preach? We always preach that you are saved by faith alone. The Bible uses the word justified by faith alone. It's like God takes a gavel, bangs it down, and says, though you are a wicked sinner, I am declaring you not guilty because my Son, Jesus Christ's righteousness, has been credited to you. We call that imputed righteousness. Well, the Eastern Church didn't talk about salvation that way. They began to develop a term that you've probably not heard of before, a term called theosis. Write that down, T-H-E-O-S-I-S, and Google it. Theosis was the view that God saves you to become like God. Theosis means to become God, deification, to change into God. In other words, they believed this, that salvation was something you do with God. You cooperate with God. Salvation is you fighting the fight of faith, growing in holiness every day to save yourself in essence one day. Whereas we as gospel-believing Christians, products of the West, would say you are not saved by any element of your works. It does sound similar because we believe in sanctification. We believe that you are slowly changed into the image of Jesus slowly and surely, and one day you will be glorified and become like your Lord, but it is totally a work of grace. Whereas the Eastern Orthodox Church began to develop the belief that you needed to work or cooperate with God to grow in holiness, and the whole point of being saved was theosis, to become like Him. That's the first thing I want you to see. There was a theological drift beginning. I want you to also notice in this theological drift, there was styles of worship that started to change. Probably the most known element of Eastern Orthodoxy that you're probably familiar with is their worship of icons. Y'all ever heard of icons or iconography? I'll show you one up on the screen. This is the most famous icon of Jesus, an early one of Jesus. They literally will worship these pictures of Jesus, of saints, of Mary. These icons are visual representations of God and the saints that inform their worship. So if you go to a Orthodox church, you will see icons everywhere. I've actually been showing you guys a lot of icons because there's no other pictures of these people. All these other ways for me to like show you their face, a lot of these are just icons that the Orthodox church has worshipped. How many of you have ever been to Israel before? Okay, so if you've been to Israel, if you've been to Jerusalem in particular, have you noticed that every place that's significant for Jesus is like a shrine? Orthodoxy. That's where you get this. It was the ostentatiousness of the Eastern Empire, the Roman Empire based out of Constantinople, that developed in this church that created all this ostentatiousness that you see in Eastern Orthodoxy. These icons are what I want you to notice. Did you notice? You guys probably can't see it because it's so small. Go Google icons and you're going to notice almost every person has their hand in a weird position. They have their hand up like this with their thumb touching their ring finger and three fingers pointed in a particular pattern. Here's what's happening. The thumb and the ring finger represent the two natures of Christ coming together, God and man. The three remaining fingers represent the Trinity, Father, Son, and Spirit. The shape they're in, I know you're not going to be able to pick up on this, they spell out in Greek Jesus Christ, the first two letters of Jesus Christ in Greek. Almost every icon, they're holding their fingers up like this in this image that says Jesus Christ, two natures, Trinitarian. It's actually kind of cool. That's one of the few things you can look at and say, oh, that's kind of something. Iconography. I want you to see this. Now, there was a political drift. As you might imagine, you've got these emperors. Constantine started Constantinople, and now you've got an emperor named Justinian who came after Constantinople. He's the one who kind of spearheaded all the craziness that was the East, which, by the way, here's a new word that I know you've heard of before. Do you want to know what the word was used to describe the Roman Empire once it moved completely to the East? Once Rome fell, it basically gained a new name called the Byzantine Empire. Y'all ever heard that word? Byzantium, Byzantine. Byzantine culture, Byzantine Christianity exploded at these centuries. And lastly, and I'll pray us out with this, the last thing you'll notice is that there was a leadership split, as I told you. There were people following the Pope, and there were people following the Patriarch of Constantinople. It would happen all the more seriously in the year 1000. I think I have a picture of the Patriarch of Constantinople. I'm pretty sure that's the guy to this day. Unlike the Pope, he views himself as not the leader of the Orthodox Church. He views himself as the first among equals. He's like a representative, but he has no real authority over the church. So not only are there two different people, there's two different theories of church government. The Western Church, the Roman Catholic Church, followed the hierarchy of the Pope, and the Eastern Church followed a more broad, first among equals view, where all the patriarchs and bishops and whatnot kind of linked arms together in synods. My friends, that wraps up for us the early church history, the first six centuries of the Christian church. You need to close your notebook, file it away. I encourage you to go back and watch these again. You're going to want to brush up because we will not come back to the 7th century, the Middle Ages, until sometime in the spring of 2022. Next Wednesday, when you come, we will conclude this semester. It's hard to believe there's only six Wednesday nights left. It's before Christmas break. It's unbelievable. We have six more Wednesday nights where we will walk through with Pastor Clint the Pentateuch. We'll turn a page and now address the Bible, these first five books of the Old Testament. So I hope you'll be back here next Wednesday night. I won't see you on Wednesdays, but I will see you on Sunday. Why don't you join me as we pray and we'll call it a night. Let's pray together. Father in heaven, once again, seal your fingerprints throughout history to the hearts of these dear people. I pray, O God, that their faith would be strengthened, their mind would be enlightened, and they would glory in the fact that you are a providential God who has been orchestrating all things for your glory and the good of your people. Do this, I pray, for Jesus' sake. Amen. Good night, everybody. We'll see you.